Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 15th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Spirit for Living, Practicing Steadfast Love, presented by Michael Wilker. Disc number WIM 2005-02.
My name is Mike Wilker. I'm the director of the Lutheran Volunteer Corps, and I live in Washington, D.C. right now, where the office of the Lutheran Volunteer Corps is. And let me just tell you a little bit about LVC before we get into the rest of the session here. The Lutheran Volunteer Corps is a one-year service program. All of our volunteers work in the United States in 10 different cities: Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Wilmington, Delaware, Chicago, Milwaukee, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Seattle, Tacoma, and now the San Francisco Bay Area. And so there are 90 folks, 21 years and older, who are spending a year of their lives working for social justice in the first place. They work anywhere from homeless shelters to meal programs to running after-school programs in congregations or in the community. They also might be doing refugee resettlement programs, working directly with refugees, or being a volunteer coordinator, where other people are actually working with the refugees or with homeless folks, and our volunteer is more working with folks that are going to volunteer in the shelters from church groups and other community organizations. The volunteers may also work in advocacy groups like in Washington, D.C., the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services has a two-person office on Capitol Hill working on legislative issues related to immigrants. And so one of those two people is a Lutheran volunteer this year. And so she's working on Capitol Hill, talking to Congress people and their staff about Lutheran perspectives on public policy related to immigrants. Whereas some of her colleagues are actually doing refugee resettlement or personal advocacy with refugees in Minneapolis, where we've got volunteers. We've also got volunteers working in disability rights organizations or working directly with people who are disabled, like at L'Arche Communities. L'Arche is a international program where they set up communities of disabled adults as well as other adults that are assistants in the community. And one of our volunteers works on a farm where all of the community members work to grow flowers and vegetables for sale at the farmers market in the Tacoma area. And in that way, she provides assistance to the L'Arche community residents, and they then get a little bit of income from the sale of their produce, but mostly feel like they're contributing life to the rest of the Tacoma area by this joint work that they're doing. So there's a lot of great things going on with LVC, and if you want to know more about that, you can talk to me after the session. Today's session, so there's the work for justice. And yesterday, the session that I led was on working for justice and or making justice. Today's session is going to be on a second tenet or value of LVC. It's about community. All of these volunteers live in households of 4 to 6 people and form intentional community with one another in their household. And so today's session is about community building or practicing steadfast love. I like to use that phrase. And tomorrow, I'm going to talk a little bit with folks about our third tenet, and that is exploring a simpler lifestyle. And so tomorrow, we'll be able to look at that tenet and explore that in conversation. Now, yesterday, we talked a little bit about what it means to make justice. To give a summary, Beverly Harrison, a woman from Minnesota who grew up in Laverne, Minnesota, and then became a professor at Union Theological Seminary in New York, one of the nation's preeminent social ethicists or Christian ethicists. She talks about justice as extending love throughout the whole community of relationships. So justice is a way to bring the love of God into all of our relationships and to set them aright through the power of love. And today, I'd like to share with you a tool that I've learned on how to help extend love throughout both a residential community, like our volunteers live in, as well as a congregational community, in which I worked in for 10 years. Now I've been a parish pastor before I became the director of LVC. Works in congregational community, and it works on a neighborhood or regional community basis too. And this is a tool called Individual Relational Meeting. I'll explain, and you're gonna actually practice this a little bit later on in the session. Before we get into that tool too much, I'd like to share a biblical story with you about Mary and Elizabeth. So I have to get out my Bible here. Was that working for you?
That one wasn't working, and I find I don't need one with you. Your voice carries well.
Okay, good. And I noticed that you wanted one, so I was kind of directing my voice a lot to you, too. So I'll keep on trying to help that out. In the Gospel according to Luke, there are these amazing epiphanies that happen where the angel Gabriel comes and visits a couple of folks. Visits in the Gospel of Luke, Gabriel comes first to Zechariah, who's married to Elizabeth, and they're both elderly folks. And Gabriel says to Zechariah, your wife Elizabeth is going to have a baby. And Zechariah is dumbfounded by this and cannot speak because he doesn't really believe it's ever going to happen. And yet he goes home and Elizabeth becomes pregnant, and 9 months later they become the parents of a boy named John, who becomes John the Baptist. Well, Gabriel's busy. He also goes to Mary, a young woman who he tells her that by the power of the Holy Spirit, you're going to become pregnant. And this is the story from the Bible. Mary said to the angel, "How can this be, since I'm a virgin?" And the angel said to her, "The Holy Spirit will come upon you, and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. Therefore, the child to be born will be holy, and he will be called Son of God. And even now your relative Elizabeth, in her old age, has also conceived a son. And this is the sixth month for her who was said to be barren, for nothing will be impossible with God." Then Mary said, "Here am I, the servant of the Lord. Let it be with me according to your word." Then the angel departed from her. In those days, Mary set out and went with haste to a Judean town in the hill country, where she entered the house of Zechariah and greeted Elizabeth. When Elizabeth heard Mary's greeting, the child leaped in her womb, and Elizabeth was filled with the Holy Spirit and exclaimed with a loud cry, "Blessed are you among women, and blessed is the fruit of your womb. And why has this happened to me, that the mother of my Lord comes to me? For as soon as I heard the sound of your greeting, the child in my womb leapt for joy. And blessed is she who believed that there would be a fulfillment of what was spoken to her by the Lord." And Mary said, "My soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior, for he has looked with favor on the lowliness of his servant." And then Mary continues on with what we know as Mary's song, the Magnificat. I like to point out the visitation, it's called in the church. Mary going to visit Elizabeth is called the Visitation. After the Annunciation of Gabriel to Mary, there comes the Visitation. And it refers not to Gabriel visiting Mary, but Mary visiting Elizabeth. Imagine being young Mary, who has just been told by an angel, that you're going to be pregnant, and you're not married yet. And all the fear and trembling that may be surfacing in your heart, all the ways that this is turning your world upside down, all the ways that, yeah, you have a sense that this is a holy and amazing thing that you're a part of, and that, yes, here I am, Lord, I'm your servant. And yet, boy, don't you need to go and talk to somebody? Fortunately, Gabriel said, and even Elizabeth, your relative. Renita Weems, another really amazing theologian, says that phrase, even Elizabeth, is a reminder to all of us that when we feel alone and in a unique situation, that there's probably actually another person that also feels their world is being turned upside down. Another person that you might find has something in common with your experience. And indeed, even Elizabeth was having her world turned upside down in some holy and amazing ways. But still, what's going to happen to my body when I'm X number of years old and I give birth to a child? And how am I going to care for this little toddler running around? And oh, so Elizabeth's world was probably getting turned upside down too by this new baby that was going to be born. And so the power of the visitation, I call it the power of two. People talking with one another and finding out in an artful conversation what the other person is most afraid of, what they cherish most about what's happening in their lives right now. But unlike an interview, if you were a newspaper reporter, just finding that out from Elizabeth, Mary and Elizabeth share with one another. Elizabeth says some things. Wow, I can't believe that the mother of my Lord is coming to me. What's going on here? And Mary responds, well, this is what's important to me, is that God remembered me. God raised up this lowly servant. And in this, I see that God is going to turn all these tables around. And so the powerful are going to be removed from their thrones. And our people are going to be saved. And so there's this conversation that goes back and forth. And I think Mary and Elizabeth have an artful individual relational meeting with one another that sustains them, and probably over the 3 months that Mary stays with Elizabeth, helps nourish them and continues to help them organize in some very practical ways. Okay, so Elizabeth, when the baby's born, who's going to help you? Who's going to be here after I have to leave to go back, Mary's saying, go back to my hometown? Who's going to provide childcare for you? Who's going to get food for that first month that you're nursing your baby and taking care of your body to recover from the birth? Where's the baby going to live or sleep? What other things do you need while we're here? So there's some practical things that are going on. But there's also some probably reflection, some theologizing that happens in the conversation too, where they're thinking about, how is God acting in all of this? What is going to happen in the future in God's plan? How are we a part of that, Elizabeth? How are we a part of that, Mary? What are you afraid of? Those kinds of questions they might be sharing with one another. Any comments or responses about this story of Mary and Elizabeth, about this visitation? Any of your own insights into this visitation of these two women? Do you remember back to conversations that you had that might have been a little bit like Mary and Elizabeth, where you found another person to talk with, to share a little bit about the fears and the hopes that you had, sharing some things that you cherished with another person?
I wonder how she talked over her relationship with Joseph. They were betrothed, and yet he was not going to be the father of this child.
Yeah.
And she must have discussed that with Elizabeth.
Yeah, you almost think that the way the Bible story puts it is that she had the Annunciation, and in Luke's version of the story, immediately she went with haste to Elizabeth. So even before she really talked to Joseph, according to the Gospel of Luke, she's going off, help me, Elizabeth, how do I deal with this, perhaps?
Well, in those days, in that culture, she probably wouldn't have much contact with Joseph, even if she was betrothed. They wouldn't be having tents that didn't talk things over like people do nowadays.
Right, not a whole lot of private conversation, perhaps, unless it was off there in the public square, and there was a whole bunch of other people kind of around them. Not a whole lot of private conversations just between the two, perhaps.
It's kind of amazing that Elizabeth believes Mary's story. I mean, even though her own baby leaped, you know, an older woman might think, what have you been doing?
Yeah. There is, I think what you're seeing is that in the conversation, they honor each other. They honor the other person's story. It's not a debate between two people. Well, that can't happen, Mary. Or, I don't believe it, Elizabeth. What's going on with you? You know, there's nothing. They actually honor each other in the conversation, even though they might have questions. Like, maybe Elizabeth did say, how did this happen? But it was, the question would be asked out of genuine curiosity and not as a way to put Mary on the spot or to make Mary feel defensive. Mm-hmm. Any other comments?
We asked about times when we've had experienced that kind of relationship.
Yeah.
And I am... suffered from infertility and then I conceived my daughter through in vitro fertilization. Mm-hmm. And the nurse at the time had also, that was the main person we were working with, had also struggled with infertility. Uh-huh. And had gone through IVF. And so I was so grateful that she had that experience. It made my experience so much easier to deal with because she had been there and knew what I was going through. So that was a huge help and a blessing at the time. Mm-hmm.
It's good to find another person and to find some commonality. Mm-hmm. Recognizing her experience might have been different than yours,
right,
in some ways, but still being able to learn from both the commonality and the difference. Yeah.
Elizabeth also had been given the gift of the Holy Spirit, which could undoubtedly have been a help, and that wasn't true yet. The Holy Spirit was not generally given until the time of Pentecost. Mm-hmm. And I believe there was God working with it to help them through the situation.
Yeah, the Spirit's very much evident in the story. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we do skip over that, but it's very significant in Luke's Gospel that the Holy Spirit helped Elizabeth speak.
Yeah.
And listen and have that conversation. In that sense, she was a prophet in the very Old Testament traditional sense. The Spirit came upon Isaiah, and he spoke. Luke is saying the Spirit came upon Elizabeth, not Zechariah, the priest, her husband.
He couldn't speak.
You know, like, he couldn't speak. The Spirit came upon Elizabeth. And the Spirit, definitely in this biblical story, endows Mary with the ability to speak and to sing this amazing song. Another thing about Mary's song, how she responds, is that she is also remembering the traditions of her past. Mary's song is probably based upon an ancient song that Hannah sang way back in the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament. Hannah also was, well, she was different than Mary. She was a woman of childbearing age, but she was not able to have a child for a long time. And she prayed to the Lord to allow her to have a child, and she finally did become pregnant, and she sang a song of the Lord's deliverance and salvation and blessing and being able to be pregnant and have a child. And Hannah's song is echoed in Mary's song. And so in Mary's part of telling her own story and interpreting what's going on, she relates it to her past, or to her people's ancient past, too. I'd like to have you all pair up a little bit and talk a little bit about part of your own personal history, your past, with one another, and just simply share with the other person a story of how you came to live in the place where you're living right now. Not Holden Village, unless you actually are living here as a staff member or long-term resident, but share where you live and how you ended up living there. Was it because your great-great-grandparents moved to Minnesota from Norway and they settled on a farm, and so your family has lived on that farm or in that area ever since they first came to the United States? Or did you, like me, I grew up in Minnesota, but because of the Lutheran Volunteer Corps, I moved to Chicago, and then I went to D.C., and there's a whole story that I have about how I ended up to now be living in Washington, D.C. So share that story a little bit, and like with the example of the Norwegian great-grandparents, you might go back a few generations to tell the story. But share that story a little bit with the other person. And we'll take about, if you could, it's going to be just a short period of time. Take 7 minutes, each of you, to tell how your family ended up living where you are right now. Okay? And if you'd like, mix around and talk with somebody that you don't know yet. Okay? So you two, you can talk to each other, or you can call for another partner.
I can't do it.
So you've just had a little bit of a conversation telling a bit of the part of the story of your lives with another person and heard a little bit about their story. So I wanted to just so-called debrief that with you all a little bit. First of all, how did it feel? A couple of words here and there. How did it feel to share in that way with another person?
Good.
It was fun. Yeah, it was nice. I always like to hear stories.
It felt fun. It was enjoyable.
Yeah.
It was
enjoyable.
Uh-huh.
Just to do with it.
Okay. Yeah. Anybody feel uncomfortable? No butterflies in your stomach about talking to somebody that maybe you didn't know before?
Well, I'm talking to Stacy, who I feel is, I attended her lecture last night, and I feel she is very exceptional.
All right.
Yes, maybe I did.
Yes.
Well, and we're all women here except you, and maybe that's something that women do more.
Yeah.
It could be, yes. Women do tend to be more artful in the conversation end of things, and men sometimes tend to be more dominating, or they have a harder time sometimes knowing some of the skills of helping elicit someone else's story. Did you just listen to the other person? Just listen. Or were there ways, think back on when the other person was telling their story, did you help them tell their story in some ways, either by questions that you asked them or by your body language?
We each asked questions.
So you asked questions. What were some of the questions that you asked that you felt were helpful in helping the other person tell their story? Share some of those questions.
Well, the first thing is just finding out where she came from.
where are you from?
Yeah.
Something very simple like that. What were some of the other questions?
Well, one, to my defense, asked when she asked if she had children, and she didn't. She married, and so I asked her how she felt about that.
I wonder. That takes a lot of sensitivity to ask a question like that, and not to feel like you're prying, but you were probing in the good sense, going a little bit deeper and asking a feeling question. How did you feel about that? How did that feel to have her ask you that question?
that's not an unusual question that I get asked. So, and it's something I'm comfortable talking about. But I can imagine that, you know, in different circumstances, some people might be defensive or feel like, well, that's none of your business or whatever. But I mean, she had told me her life, and I was happy to tell her that.
You could ask a question like that because you'd already shared something about your own life. And so there was a reciprocal aspect going on here. It was a mutual conversation. And so you felt more comfortable responding and opening up a little bit more. You got to learn a little bit more about your partner because you had also shared. So when we share a story from our own lives, it helps the other person also share a story from their life. Did anybody ask why questions? Did any of you ask a why? A question that started with why? Did you?
I think we did.
Yeah,
I thought there was a lot of those why.
Why?
What they were.
Yeah,
why are you asking me that?
Well, because just to be sensitive, when you ask a why question, a general human response is to get a little defensive. Because why sounds like a challenge rather than an invitation to share more. So you sometimes can ask why questions when you feel more comfortable in the relationship. But I bet a number of you might have wondered, I wonder why she did that. But if you didn't ask a why question, you probably, because I think you're pretty artful already at this, probably phrased it in a different way. Well, What were you thinking about when you decided to move to Seattle? You know, that kind of question, rather than, why did you move to Seattle? Then they're going like, well, because. It could start shutting down a conversation rather than continuing to open it up. There are ways that you can develop conversational skills, and it's helpful to be intentional about that, especially when you're trying to create community. Community doesn't just happen. It takes people intentionally working at building community. Sometimes we think that it just happens, but there is groundwork that needs to be laid. And we forget all the groundwork that had been laid that allows community to seemingly spontaneously blossom. That children can form community among their classmates or in their school probably happens because parents and other adults in the community have worked hard to create a healthy environment for them to gather, a place where they can be safe, good teachers around them, carpooling to and from school, other extracurricular activities, all those things prepared the ground for the children themselves to form community. Same way with us adults. It takes some work to prepare the ground for community to be able to blossom. And having artful and skilled conversations is one of those ways that you can form community. In California, where I was a pastor, the town is called Watsonville, California, and it's along the Monterey Bay coast, and about 90 miles south of San Francisco, and it was about 70% Latino, mostly Mexican and Mexican Americans, and a large number were recent immigrants to the United States. They had gone through the immigrant journey, and one of the Latina leaders in town talked to me about the difference between the communities that the Mexicans were coming from and Watsonville at the time that we were both living there. She talked about the network of women and mothers in the town where she knew a lot of these folks came from, and how that she called it, when you've got a really good friend that's another woman, in Mexico or in Spanish, you call that person a comadre. And sometimes they're your child's godmother, okay? So your child's godmother would be your comadre. And you have this really close bond. She called that down in Mexico, in the home community of a lot of these folks, there's a comadre network, she called it, mm-hmm. where we, in other times, maybe in the United States, you might have called it, it's the backyard network over the fence. Mm-hmm. Lean in there because you're hanging up the laundry and you're talking about what's going on in your lives. And you're actually doing a little bit of organizing, too, if you think about it. How are we going to get these kids in school? You know, they don't want to go. The teacher doesn't seem to be doing a good job this year. What do you think? And, well, have you talked to Joe about it? You know, Joe's on the school board. I don't really know him. Well, I know Mavis, and Mavis is married to Joe. So let's go talk to Mavis, and then she'll talk to Joe. And so that was one way of organizing and making sure that the kids had good schools. There were also other ways to do it, too. My great-grandmother in northern Minnesota was more in a traditional way organizing public school districts in northern Minnesota when she was a young woman having school kids of her own age. And she gathered people together in public meetings in order to actually found legally the school districts in northern Minnesota to raise her kids up in. But these comadre networks that existed in Mexico because of the immigrant experience kind of had been ripped apart, and they needed to be reformulated in some intentional way in Watsonville in order to help Watsonville be a healthy community once again. And so we used these individual relational meetings, and we started teaching people how to do these in their churches, first of all with one another, in their own congregations, and then from the people in the congregation to people in other congregations that we're all going through this work together, and then also with people outside the churches that didn't have an affiliation directly with the congregation. And in this way, there was definitely one of the people in the conversation was the initiator. One person, a leader of the congregation, or a group of leaders like the church council, committed to doing these individual relational meetings with other members of the congregation. So, for example, I would commit to doing, to having an individual relational meeting with five other people that were about a half an hour to 45 minutes in the congregation at some time during the month between one council meeting and the next. And so I would be responsible for deciding who I wanted to talk to and to call them up and say, I'd like to talk with you for about 30 to 45 minutes. Just to find out more about your life right now, what you think about our congregation, how you like living in Watsonville, stuff like that. So in that initial invitation, I have set a time limit so that they know it's 30 to 40 minutes, 45 minutes. It's not going to go on for hours. I might suggest a cup of coffee, but it's not to come over and have a big meal with me or something like that. It's to keep it defined. And then I also say a little bit, I give them a clue that I want to find out a bit about what's important, what they care about. And they might ask me, why? And could say, well, because I'm a leader in the congregation, and one of the responsibilities of a leader is to know how people are thinking and feeling in our congregation. And so we're all doing this on the council or in whatever group it is as a way to keep on getting to know members of our congregation and to find out what's important in your life. So you can have these, there's an initiator usually in these conversations. But you can also do what we just did right here, is in a congregational meeting or a gathering, throw out a question for people to pair up on, so they can share a story with one another. Ask them to share a story from their own personal experience and try to come up with a question that is general enough and specific enough to help them be able to share a story. So the one, how did your family come to live here in this community? It can surface some amazing stories in the congregation. Wow. Like we did this once, my congregation found out that there was a woman who had been, was from Sacramento originally, and she moved to Watsonville as a single mother because her family had kicked her out of the home because she had gotten pregnant when she was single. And she had moved to Watsonville, but that was 40 years ago. And her child was now an adult, not living in our community, and none of the existing members of the congregation knew that about her, and yet that gave her an opportunity to share. And so some of the other women in the congregation that also had felt a little bit of ostracism because of what they had gone through in their life suddenly saw in Bessie someone they could talk to, someone that they shared a little bit of a common experience with. So, and you, in these forums like this, you share what you want to. So she didn't have to tell about that, but she felt comfortable sharing that story in that setting. And that's a good thing to remember, is that these are not private sharing times, really. They're a little bit more on the public end of things. They're stories that, because the initiator usually is a leader of the congregation, you know that most of it is going to be kind of part of the public story of your congregation. There may be times in a conversation like this when someone shares something that verges on the very private, and then you'll want to clarify. That sounds like something very private. I'll hold that in confidence if you'd like me to. And just be very explicit with the other person to make sure that they know that you've understood that piece of their story is a very personal and private part of their story that you'll hold in confidence. And if there's things in the story or in their sharing with you that you would like to share with other people back at your community organizing group or the church council, make sure that you get permission to do that too. Just be explicit about that part of it as well. Wow, your experience as being a Sunday school teacher, I'd really like to share that with the council. Do I have your permission to do that? Because I think that would really help us think about education in the congregation. And then they might say, yeah, well, that's why I told you it to you. That's why I told you the story. That'd be good. So think about those kinds of things. Up here on the board, I know it's kind of far away from where you all are sitting, so I'll say it. It'll help me remember that I get to share everything that I want to share about this. So individual relational meeting, it's sometimes referred to as a one-to-one conversation, because most of the times, the best of these are face-to-face. Over the phone or over email doesn't really do it as well as being able to have a face-to-face. And you know why, face-to-face, there's more energy. You can feel the spirit between you sometimes. So what these are is that it's a natural conversation. Takes a little bit of skill and intentionality, a little bit of artfulness involved in it to recognize what questions, like when you asked, I don't know your two names right now.
Ruth and Viola.
Viola. Mm-hmm. Like how you, Viola, how you asked that question, and you were artful in asking it at what seemed to be the right time in an appropriate space. So it takes a little bit of art, but it's also intentional. It's not necessarily spontaneous. You could sit down after church during the coffee hour and have an individual relational meeting with somebody, but they might not have time to give you 30 to 45 minutes right then and there. So you probably want to set it up intentionally to have that conversation over on the side right there and grabbing your cup of coffee and having the conversation. And the other person knows that that's what this is about. It's not just coffee chit-chat. We're going to share a little bit more deeply. And it's focused. Usually when the initiator goes into one of these conversations, there is some reason that they're curious about the other person. Like, one, I haven't done this recently this way, but I'd like to. Now that my daughter is in second grade, I'd like to go and intentionally ask some of the other dads in Maya's school, my daughter's school, basically what it's like to be a dad in Washington, D.C. What are the things that they struggle with, being a dad to their children? do they have time to take care of their kids, or do they feel like they're always working all the time and they come home so tired at night that they never have any time to just play and hang out with their kids? Or do they feel like they're worried about their child's college education? As a second, my daughter's a second grader, and yeah, I'm already wondering, you know, it's only,
third grade.
She's going to be third grader now. It's only it's 9 years now, and she's going to go off to college. So what kind of finances am I going to have? Or what do I need to be worried about? Will we have quality universities for Maya, especially public universities for Maya when she's ready to go off to college? I wonder if any other dads feel like that or worry about stuff like that. So I might focus these individual relational meetings with other dads around some educational issues that I would try and share. Okay, this is what I'm worried about. Do you worry about that? And just find out a little bit about what's going on in their lives. Sharing a little bit around a bit of a focused conversation around them being dads of my daughter's classmates. What it's not, this is really helpful. It's not a sales pitch. Having an individual relational meeting, you're not trying to sell somebody else on an idea. For example, back in Watsonville, we were an English-speaking congregation in a 50% Spanish-speaking community. So at one point, we needed to get a new sign out front. And so our evangelism team had decided that the sign was going to be in Spanish and English. They were going to bring it to the council meeting. And by the time it got to the council meeting, the rumors had gone out that there is people that are upset that we're going to have Spanish on our sign. And we better not do it. Our council had just earlier that day in the council meeting had had a training on these individual relational meetings. So each council member decided that within the next month, they would each go and visit one other member of the congregation. And we actually named the people that we heard via these rumors were most concerned about Spanish on the sign. And we told each other, we want to hear what their concerns are. Why are they worried that we're going to have Spanish on the sign? But we didn't use the word why. What are your concerns? You know, we phrased those questions that way. And then, but we also said, but this isn't an interview. We're not just taking a survey of these 12 people. The council members, since they all had previously said this is what they wanted to do, they had to go and share why it was important to them as members of the congregation as well. But it wasn't supposed to be a sales job. They weren't supposed to say, well, Mary, I think this is so important because this and this and the other thing. Now, what's it going to take for you to agree with me? It wasn't a council member going and selling the other member of the congregation on why we should have Spanish on the sign. It was, you know, Mary, I feel really strongly about this because my neighbors are Spanish speaking and I would really love for them to be able to come to our church, but they don't think they're welcome because we don't do anything in Spanish. And if we had a sign that was in Spanish and in English, my neighbors would feel more welcome to come to our church. And I love our church and I want more people to know what we love. And it wasn't asking Mary to agree. It was just asking Mary to hear why it was so important to Corrine. And then asking Mary to share. What turns out is that there were a few people that were really unhappy. Some of them didn't even want to have a conversation. Nope, don't want to talk about it. You don't have to come by. Nope. Others, like Mary, it turns out that her criticism of the sign was to help improve it. She said, well, you know, since the school is on that side where all the kids are going to school, maybe you should have something in Spanish that relates to kids so that when they come from the school, they can see something in Spanish related to kids. That was her critique, but it had been through the rumor mill, oh, she doesn't want to have the son. So they came back, and the council, after having shared what was important to them with one with other members of the congregation, came back and they affirmed their decision, and they went forward with having Spanish and English on the sign. But it wasn't a sales pitch. It's also not asking for a volunteer. How many of you in congregations always, you know, oh, you know, how would you like to do this? You know, come and help me out on this. And all. It's not a recruiting tool to have them come and join your project. It's also not counseling. Some people who are pastors often can fall into this, or members can put pastors into a counseling situation when we go out and try to do an individual relational meeting with them, because there's very important pastoral concerns that the other person may have. There may be issues brought up that turn into a pastoral counseling situation, but then you should be intentional and explicit about that this has shifted. Let's move into another way of having this conversation, because this is a counseling situation now, and I want to help you as your pastor in this very particular situation. The pastor then might go, or the Stevens minister then might go into a reflective listening mode, where rather than the pastor or the Stevens minister sharing all of his own or her own personal stuff, oh yeah, I remember that time when I was back in Minnesota and this thing happened to me too. In a counseling situation, you wouldn't do that. In a counseling situation, whether you're a layperson or a pastor, you'd say something like, that sounds like it was really a tough time for you when this happened. That's a different kind of a conversation. And if it moves into that direction and you've got responsibilities in the congregation as a Stevens minister or as a pastor, then you might have to just be explicit about that and say, okay, let's deal with it this way. And then you have to shut up in a way. But in a one-on-one, it's more of an equal relationship where you're both going to be sharing back and forth. So how I like to tell people when they're initiating these conversations is that you want to learn and share what you cherish most. Try to discover a little bit about what they cherish most. My daughter and my son are the things that I cherish most right now. I could give up my job, I could move to another city, as long as I knew that our son and daughter were being well cared for. That's what I cherish most. Learn and share, if you can, in these gently probing, not prying ways, what causes them pain. Beverly Harrison gave a famous talk in the 80s about the power of anger in the work of love. The power of anger in the work of love. She talked about how that when a person is angry, when they have grief over something, that it is a recognition in their body or in the community that something is not right. And a loving response, or to extend that love throughout the community in justice, is an opportunity to listen and respond to the anger. And in these artful individual conversations, you may be able to listen and help someone who's been very angry about something or has some pain over something be able to voice it. It's a very holy exchange that you might be able to be a part of. And understanding a little bit about what causes the other person pain may be able to give you some ideas on how to make a more just and loving community. And so, if you can, learn a little bit about what causes them pain, either currently or in the past, and how tender that pain may still be. In a way, what you're doing when you find out what they cherish most, or what causes the other person pain, and you're sharing that also with them, is that you're sharing what motivates you. We're motivated by the things that we value most and by the things that have caused us grief or pain. That's one way to think about what motivates us. There's some other ways to talk about that too, but you're learning in this exchange about what makes you tick, what makes your heart beat and pulse, what makes it race faster, what makes it leap for joy. And like Mary and Elizabeth were having their own babies leap for joy inside them. One last thing I put down at the bottom here is commitment and recognition. A few years ago, we had a lot of talk in the United States about racial dialogue. We had town hall meetings that President Clinton was helping to facilitate, and Oprah Winfrey was helping to facilitate. But the difference in these town hall meetings is that for the most part, the people didn't have any commitment to one another. They could share their stories back and forth, but there was no commitment that they were actually going to work on them together. In a congregation, or in a focused intentional community organizing project, or in the intentional communities that LVC has, there's a commitment to be together. And I think to have these individual relational meetings within that umbrella of commitment makes it different than just two people meeting on a plane somewhere. You might learn really good and amazing things about a fellow citizen of the United States, and we have a commitment as citizens of the United States, or another citizen of the world, but it's kind of big and broad, a little hard to get a handle on at times, that large of a commitment. But if you think about the commitment that you have as congregational members with one another, or as housemates in an intentional community, that your commitment to be in community with one another binds you to help work with each other to care for what you cherish and to resolve what's given you some grief. And that changes the conversation in a qualitatively different way. So sometimes you need, I put recognition up next to it. Sometimes you need to help people recognize the commitment too. That, like if I did this meeting with the dads of my daughter's classmates, by helping both of us recognize that we're both, because we're parents, we're both committed to helping our school be better. You might need to check that out. Some parents aren't committed. but to voice that we have a commitment to one another because we're neighbors and we both have children in this school. So that the conversation takes place within that commitment. We have until, I'm 4 minutes over, aren't I? Okay. I'm going to stop, but I'm going to give you a chance if there's any questions that any of you want to stay and ask me or have some more talking about. Any questions? If I could then add two more sentences. So you have these individual relational meetings, and say that you start to find out, like if I do these dads' individual relational meetings, that three or four of them are having problems because their children may need special education of some sort. And they're not sure if that's available at our school, or they're worried about the quality of special education. And I know that now, that there's three. Then I might go back to them and invite them to all three come together with me and say, you know, I found two other dads that are worried about special education in our school. Would you meet with me and the other two? Let's talk about that concern. Let's find out if there's anything else that we share in common around that concern, or that issue. And then as we get together in that small group, we might come up with a strategy together for how we could all go to the principal together, or one of us go and find out a little bit more information. And it might end up in a process changing the situation to improve the special education opportunities in our school. As you do these individual relational meetings, you might surface up some common issues, some common grief, or some common things that you cherish that you can work together as a small group on to help build your community and make it stronger and healthier. This is the tool that you can then build upon to make improvements in your congregation or your community. So there's my time with you all. And I'm here for you if you want to talk any more individually with me and ask me other questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.